Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Implications of Recent Datasets for the Current and Future Management of Breast Cancer. We have a great faculty today, and of course, we're going to be talking a lot about the recent ESMO meeting. So we're going to be joined by Dr. Aditya Bardia from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, and Dr. Sarah Tulaney from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, also in Boston. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As we always do for our webinars, we put a one-minute pre-meeting survey in the chat room. If you take that and the one we put in right at the end of the meeting, you'll get a lot more out of this experience. This is part of our sort of post-ESMO fall. We did a program on Tuesday on gynecologic cancers. Next Tuesday, we're actually going to spend an hour and a half talking about lung cancer because we couldn't do it in an hour, but that should be very interesting. And then on Thursday, we'll finish out our series with Dr. Bardia's colleague, Dr. Klempner, talking about gastroesophageal cancers. And then we'll be back on the 29th of November talking about biliary tract cancers. And then we'll head out to San Antonio, as we always do. We'll be doing three satellite meetings there. If you're in San Antonio, drop one by. If not, check it out live and online. And then we'll be flipping over to San Diego the next day to do four symposia at the ASH meeting. Same thing. We'll be going from 7:30 in the morning till 9 at night. All that will be online. And then we're reawakening our weekend CME program for general medical oncologists. We did a couple of these before the pandemic. We're joining, hooking up with the Florida Cancer Specialists. We're going to do another weekend at the Marriott Turnberry Resort in March. So come on down to Miami and join us here. We know a lot of people like to listen to our webinars. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program with Dr. MacArthur on breast cancer. But we're going to take a crack at trying to decipher what happened at the, particularly at the ESMO meeting, a few things from the ASCO meeting and this past summer as well. As we always do, we will be getting into unapproved indications for treatment. So we're going to really focus on the risk-benefit equation that particularly new therapies present. So we asked our faculty to put together some slides going through some of these key papers. Here are the papers that we want to talk about, or at least note today. We won't be able to get into all in depth, but we want to really talk about what was presented and particularly how it ties in to the way we're approaching treatment. We're going to start out talking a little bit about the issue. We actually talked about this Tuesday night in the GYN program of pan-tumor approvals of agents. And then we'll get into some of the papers. First, we'll talk about ER-positive localized disease, including adjuvant CDK, and then we'll get into immunotherapy, including the neoadjuvant ER-positive trials presented at ESMO and probably going to be followed up, actually, at San Antonio. We'll touch base with the faculty a little bit about PARP inhibition, particularly in the Olympia strategy of the adjuvant or post-neoadjuvant. But really, what we're here today to talk about is antibody-drug conjugates, as we do a lot nowadays in our programs. But there are a lot of them to consider today in breast cancer, which we've already had a number of them over the years, including T-DM1, T-DXd, of course, sacituzumab. But a couple where we saw some really intriguing data at ESMO, and I think we're going to see more at San Antonio, on datopotamab deruxtecan, same payload, but targeting TROP2. Of course, we've been talking about the same exact drug in non-small cell lung. It was presented at ESMO. We're talking about that next week. We're also talking about patritumab next week, but also in breast cancer. So a lot to talk about. So just kind of as a warm-up, Sarah, I saw this paper in oncology talking about pan-tumor tissue-agnostic approvals in general, which I thought was a really interesting topic. They went through some of the existing pan-tumor approvals, like, for example, checkpoint inhibitors, TREC, RET, the question of whether or not T-DXd is going to be next on the list. We already are talking about T-DXd in our lung cancer programs, in our upper GI programs, in our colon programs, biliary programs. Sarah, do you think this is heading for pan-tumor approval?
I think it probably is. You know, I think one thing we've learned, even just in the breast cancer world, is that if you have a target present on a tumor, irrespective of that tumor subtype, you're seeing benefit, right? We see in HER2-low, ER-positive, triple-negative, you see similar response rates. And so I think we've learned a lesson that, you know, you can go beyond biology of an individual tumor. If the target's present, you can get chemo and you can have response. And so it's really pretty impressive to see that, you know, tremendous response you're seeing across different cancers as long as that target is there.
Aditya, any comments? And also, of course, the thing that everybody's asking us in the other tumor types is about HER2-low, because, of course, they're way behind you all in terms of research and hasn't exactly been fleshed out that well in terms of HER2-low outside of breast. But any thoughts in general about the advantages and disadvantages of these tissue-agnostic approaches, Aditya?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the challenge is even in breast cancer, HER2-low remains controversial from a definition perspective. And how do you measure HER2? So the challenge is, you know, what assay to use? Is IHC good enough? Do we need a different assay? Which specimen to use? Because we know that HER2 expression changes over time from primary to metastatic. And there was an interesting abstract at ASCO which showed that if you biopsy multiple times, up to five times, 100% of the patients will have some HER2 expression. So I think that's the challenge, how to measure HER2. The advantage is we have a drug, trastuzumab deruxtecan, that has shown activity even in low HER2 expressing breast cancer as well as other tumors. And you know, alternative would be some standard chemo rather than chemo. If you have a drug, an antibody drug conjugate that has better activity, that's attractive from a patient perspective.
And actually, Sarah, I was just flashing on the fact that a few weeks ago we were working with your colleague in GI, Dr. Enzinger, and we had a general medical oncologist presented a case. This is a patient who lived in Vietnam, and the children brought the patient over to L.A. to see this general oncologist, and he ran some tests. Patient was HER2 positive. He had esophageal HER2 positive disease, brain mets. Somehow he got the patient TDXD. The patient had a complete response. You know, Dr. Enziger was just sort of sitting back there going, whoa, you know. But I guess that could be the world that we're moving into in terms of TDXD. And, you know, a lot of these other agents, you know, we're getting ready. I mentioned we're getting ready for ASH. You know, they see responses to ALK and lymphoma. So, you know, it even crosses into hematologic cancers. All right, let's do a little bit of update. Again, I'm really pointing towards those ADCs because that's where I got all my questions. But I think it's a good, there's a bunch of other stuff that's been presented that I think is interesting to talk about. And, you know, of course, this is the most common scenario that we see. Sarah, maybe you can talk a little bit about some of the things that have come out recently, particularly in the adjuvant setting for localized disease. And, of course, obviously, CDK, a big question. Can you comment a little bit on this slide you put together?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've certainly come a long way with our adjuvant therapies and endocrine approaches. You know, we had tamoxifen, then we had aromatase inhibitors. Now we've learned about the utility of ovarian suppression, and we'll touch on a little bit today about some of the data that's really continuing to support use of ovarian suppression in our premenopausal patients. But I think there still are patients who need more. And so this, you know, graph kind of shows you that there are patients who actually do have endocrine resistant disease and they do have early events. And so trying to think about how we can help prevent recurrences, particularly in the high risk patients in that early time period, is very critical. And we've seen some data emerge to help us with that. You know, I think we've seen a lot of data that's focused on ovarian suppression and trying to capitalize on that. And use of prognostic scores to help us figure out what therapy to give to the individual patient. So I think this case kind of brings into the need for trying to tailor therapy to the individual patient. And I think this is a tough one, at least for me. This was a 54-year-old postmenopausal patient who had a high-grade ER-positive cancer. She went to upfront surgery. And her tumor was small, so it was only 9 millimeters, and it was strongly ER/PR positive and did not have any nodal involvement, but was high grade. And so, you know, I was a little bit stuck because of the tumor size here, which is on the small size, and, you know, thinking, do I really need to give this patient chemotherapy. She's 54, postmenopausal, otherwise very healthy. And so I did send an oncotype. Again, I think some would argue this maybe is a smaller cancer. Do you really need an oncotype? But the oncotype was the recurrence score came back very high at 37. And so, you know, I struggled a little bit because, you know, size also matters. It, you know, recurrence score is prognostic, but size is an independent prognostic indicator as well. And I did plug her into RS Clin, which you can do online, which helps you in your node negative patients. It allows you to plug in the tumor size, the grade, the ERPR status, and the recurrence score, and the age. And it tells you what they think the absolute benefit is of chemotherapy in the patient. And here it was around 8%. And so it seemed strikingly, you know, large enough to warrant chemotherapy. So I did end up giving her TC.
So Dee Dee, any comments about the case and how you would have thought it through?
No, it's a tough case because, you know, if you purely look at the size, 9 millimeters, one would be tempted to just consider surgery. But I think the concerning thing here is grade 3 and the high recurrence score. And we know that that is a factor that's associated with higher risk of recurrence. Plus, these are tumors that are not that endocrine sensitive. So you don't have full confidence in endocrine therapy alone. And the patient would not meet criteria for a CDK4/6 inhibitor either. So you just feel this is a tumor. I don't feel comfortable with endocrine therapy alone. I would want to give something else like chemotherapy, but ACT might be too much. So TC seems like a good balance to address this.
So in terms of recent papers in the localized ER-positive space, Sarah, this was part of the meta-analysis team from Oxford that presented data on ovarian ablation suppression, the first form of endocrine therapy for breast cancer. I'm curious what you got out of that presentation. And also, I'm curious, and I want to ask both of you, in what situations do you not use adjuvant ovarian ablation or suppression? But first, Sarah, any comments on this new data set?
This was a very large meta-analysis looking at the benefits of adding ovarian suppression to endocrine therapy. And, you know, they looked at people who were known to be premenopausal at baseline, and then those people who, you know, got chemotherapy or were retained their menses after getting chemotherapy. And my takeaway from this was that if you were known to be premenopausal upfront and you were young, you were the people who are most likely to gain the largest benefit. If you got to be over the age of 45, or you had sort of unknown menstrual status after chemotherapy, those were the people who also seemed to have less benefit from ovarian suppression. So, you know, really the people who are menstruating post-chemo or are young are the people who are gaining a lot of benefit from the use of ovarian suppression.
So, Dee Dee, I'm curious about your use of, I mean, it's, of course, a very, traditional old form of therapy, but I'm curious about, you know, it also is very effective. I'm curious about when you don't use it in the adjuvant situation. I think you can make an argument that theoretically any patient might have a theoretical benefit. But what I see is that when you get down to the lower risk, where the absolute benefit is not that great, that maybe it's not justifiable to use an intervention that's going to cause a lot of quality of life, maybe even, you know, secondary morbidity. So my question to you is, Aditya, when do you not use adjuvant ovarian ablation?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. I think the scenario where I would not use it, where there's concern about risk-benefit ratio. And so this would be in a patient with lymph node negative disease, because if you look at soft text, it was the lymph node positive subgroup where you could clearly see benefit from ovarian suppression. So patient with lymph node negative disease or patients who are, you know, 40 plus, say, you know, 45, 47, where, you know, it's possible that chemotherapy in itself could induce ovarian ablation. And I think in part, that's why we see, like in the B group, where the premenopausal status is unclear, it's possible that the chemo essentially induced, a postmenopausal state. So that would be two scenarios where I would not consider the use of ovarian suppression. But a young patient, a patient with lymph node positive disease, I think ovarian suppression should be considered.
So, Sarah, one thing that Aditya didn't comment on is whether, and I'm going to ask you, do you consider the recurrence score? You said low risk, no negative. Do you consider recurrence score in deciding on ovarian suppression, Aditya?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Based on the responder data that we have, and it's unclear because in that study, all the patients did not have ovarian suppression. But absolutely, in a patient who has high recurrence risk, you worry that this is a patient population that needs additional therapy escalation. And one strategy for therapy escalation would be ovarian suppression.
So, Sarah, we also are seeing, of course, updates on the CDK data. Like I said, the thing to me that's new is the ADC. So we have spent lots of time talking about adjuvant CDK. We saw an update on the Monarch E study, an update on the Natalie study. I wouldn't doubt that we're going to see more data at the San Antonio meeting. But can you kind of summarize where we are? You've been in the middle of this, so you both of you have for quite some time. Where we are right now today in terms of adjuvant CDK, Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we've seen now is five-year data for Monarch E suggesting almost an 8% absolute benefit from the use of adjuvant abemaciclib for 2 years. And so now with 5 years of therapy, you're seeing that benefit continue to increase over time, even when all the people have finished their upfront 2 years, suggesting some carryover effect from that abemaciclib they received. So to me, I think abemaciclib is standard of care for someone with high-risk ER-positive disease. I think the question mark is, what do you do with Natalie? To me, that's a little bit more tricky because, you know, this trial used a broader population. It included some node negative patients that had higher risk features, and then their node positive patients was any node positive patient as opposed to Monarch E, where you had to have an additional high risk feature. And we only have short follow-up from it. We only have 28 months of follow-up. And while we see that there is benefit with, you know, about a 25% risk reduction in IDFS events, it's still early. And, you know, I think people want to see the maturity of the data to make sure those curves continue to separate with larger follow-up. And I think we want to understand what the benefit truly is in the very node negative patients, because that's the group that's really going to expand utilization of CDK4/6. So for now, I'd say I think abema is standard of care, but we'll have to see a little bit more follow-up for Natalie to understand how to incorporate ribociclib.
So I want to get into immunotherapy and also some of the new data that we saw from ESMO. But just real quick, back to you, Aditya, from the chat room. Hassan, we were talking about ovarian suppression. HER2 positive, T1C, N0, ER positive, post-surgery, adjuvant Taxol, trastuzumab, 36-year-old patient. Would you use ovarian suppression?
It's a discussion with the patient, but I would not be super enthusiastic about ovarian suppression for two reasons. One is that ER-positive, HER2-positive disease is predominantly driven by HER2, at least initially, and this patient is getting Taxol plus trastuzumab, which has shown excellent outcomes. So I feel very comfortable with that regimen. And second is, you know, the concern with side effects from ovarian suppression. It's a discussion. If the patient wants absolutely everything, you could consider it, but I would not be super enthusiastic.
So let's talk a little bit about immunotherapy. And Sarah, I'm going to let you go through some of the slides related to this issue, including a bunch of things that were presented at ESMO. So maybe we can start out talking about Keynote 756 and Checkmate 7FL.
So I think we were all really excited about these data. One, personally, I never thought immunotherapy would have a big role in early stage ER positive disease. So this was really surprising to me and I think a bit exciting. So Keynote 756 took patients, in essence, with stage 2-3 ER positive cancer and randomized them to get ACT chemo with or without Pembro. And then post-surgery, they got Outback pembrolizumab if they were on the Pembro arm. And the Checkmate 7FL study is almost identical in design. It's also anthracycline taxane, but in this case, plus minus nivolumab in the preoperative setting. And then the people on the nivolumab arm get adjuvant nivolumab. One important thing to note is in Keynote 756, everyone had to have a high-grade ER-positive cancer. In 7FL, you had to be high-grade, or if you're grade 2, you had to be ER-low. So in essence, both of these trials ended up enrolling almost everyone having high-grade cancer. And what you saw was that adding checkpoint inhibition to chemo improved PCR rates. Very similarly, between both of these trials, you saw, you know, a delta of 8% in 756, and in 7FL, you know, deltas like over 10%. You know, normally we don't see a lot of PCRs in ER-positive disease. Again, this is, remember, high-grade cancer. So the PCR in the control arm is, you know, 14-15%. Usually in all comers, it's more like 8-10%. So that's why this is a little higher in the control than typical. But you're seeing, you know, we never get 25% PCR in ER-positive disease. So that's pretty striking to me. I think the question marks that came up is there a biomarker predictor for who's achieving PCR? And one question, you know, we haven't needed to use PD-L1 as a biomarker in the pre-op triple negative setting. It didn't predict who benefited from Pembro. And here in Checkmate, in Keynote 756, you know, the benefit was seen irrespective of PD-L1 status. But I will be cautious with this data because here they used the 22C3 antibody and they used a CPS of 1 as their cutoff. But, you know, as you know, in triple negative disease, we use a CPS 10 cutoff. And so we are going to want to see these data with the updated analysis with the different cutoff to understand if maybe it's going to help us predict that benefit. Because when you look at Checkmate 7FL, you see in the PD-L1 positives, there's a huge benefit. You see the PCR rates like 44% in PD-L1 positive, ER positive disease, where you're not seeing much of a difference in the PD-L1 negative patients. And here they used the SP142 IC1 cutoff, which is more like a CPS 10 with 22C3. And so that's why I think I want to see that fleshed out a little bit more. But obviously, these agents we know from our prior experience do have toxicities, immune-related toxicities. There's a death on 756 and two deaths on 7FL. So in my mind, I want to see longer-term follow-up from these trials. I want to see event-free survival. In ER-positive disease, that relationship between PCR and EFS is not quite as clear. And so I think we do need to see long-term outcomes. But there are going to be caveats because in these trials, people weren't getting CDK4/6 inhibitors. There is known toxicity with giving concurrent CDK4 and checkpoint inhibition, so you can't do that. And so we're going to have to learn, can you give sequential CDK4 after IO if this is positive? We're going to have to learn if PD-L1 is a biomarker when we see EFS data. And unfortunately, Checkmate 7FL is not powered for EFS, only Keynote 756 is. They stopped 7FL early once Abema came on board because they knew those patients couldn't get concurrent Abema IO. So I think we have a lot of questions still left about this, but really nice to see this very robust signal.
So, DT, I'm curious what your thoughts are about these two studies. It kind of reminds, we heard similar data in non-small cell lung cancer a couple years ago. They're a little bit farther ahead. Now they're seeing disease-free survival. They're trying to figure out whether to go adjuvant, neoadjuvant with you all, it seems, at least in terms of this situation. I wonder if any of these studies got genomic assays, before treatment, you know, Oncotype, to see if there's any, you know, talk about PD-1. I'd be curious what the correlation was between Oncotype and some of the outcomes. But any general thoughts about this whole topic, these trials, Aditya?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll make three quick points. The first one, the results are very exciting, consistent between these two studies. So good to see improvement in PCR for a subset of ER-positive breast cancer. The trials included patients with grade 3 disease, so it was not all ER-positive, a subset. The second is we absolutely need biomarkers because it's unlikely that all patients derive equal benefit, and whether it's going to be PD-L1 status or some other biomarker, I think that would be needed. And the third question, which we also grappling with Keynote 522, is do you need adjuvant IO? Is neoadjuvant IO sufficient, at least for some patients? That'll help address the issue of CDK4/6 because you could give neoadjuvant IO, and if a patient, say, has PCR, then in that setting, maybe use CDK4/6 or some other therapy and you don't need adjuvant IO. So I think we'll need to clarify that issue as well.
So speaking of adjuvant IO and whether you need it or not, let's see what's going on in terms of Keynote 522. So can you update us on where we are in triple negative localized disease? Also, another question I was kind of curious about, Sarah. You know, we hear so much about ctDNA and the adjuvant situation, obviously, of course, with colon cancer, but even way beyond that. I feel like at ASCO, I started to hear a lot more talk about ctDNA in breast. Do you think that somehow that's going to enter this arena?
I think it is starting to. I think our problem is that our assays are not quite sensitive enough, at least with the commercial assays currently available, and we don't really understand enough about correlation of MRD presence or negativity and outcome. Right now, I'm not so certain that our assays in the negative setting are sensitive enough to truly trust that they're negative. And so I think we need to refine these before we're ready for prime time in breast. So I'm not currently using them clinically at this point in time.
Before we get to 522, just to check back with Aditi about that, are you also not using it outside a trial setting? I hear people, you know, some situations, metastatic disease, oligometastatic disease. Any situations right now, Aditi, where you're using ctDNA?
ctDNA in the metastatic setting, yes, because it's actionable. In the adjuvant, neoadjuvant setting outside of a clinical trial, it's not actionable. So the question becomes, say you monitor with ctDNA in the adjuvant setting and a patient does have detectable ctDNA, what are you going to do with that information? So till we have something linked to that, which could be in a trial setting, it's very difficult to use it as standard of care.
Yeah, well, they did it in colon. They did the trial there, so it can be done. All right, 522. Where are we with that, Sarah?
So we've seen data from 522 already. This was more of trying to understand the five-year outcome. We've seen three-year outcome before. So just as a reminder, this was for stage 2-3 triple-negative disease. People got platinum, taxane, anthracycline, chemo with or without pembro pre-op, but then did get the adjuvant 27 weeks of pembro out back. And what you saw to the left, you see the outcomes with the three-year data. To the right, you see the outcomes with the five-year data. You see the hazard ratios are literally identical, so that relative benefit that you're gaining has held. You do see that, you know, overall, the people who got pembro now at 5 years have a five-year EFS of around 80% compared to, you know, around 72% in the patients who didn't get the pembro. But one interesting thing did come out with this analysis is if you look at the people who had PCR, when we previously saw these data at 3 year, you can see the EFS was about the same, whether you had pembro or no pembro. As long as you had a PCR, you did well, suggesting that maybe PCRs are all the same. If you just get it, no matter how you got there, you're going to do well. But here now with longer follow-up, you do see that the people who got pembro and had a PCR are doing better than the people who got chemo and had a PCR. And to me, that's kind of an important differentiator because while we know PCR is prognostic, now you're seeing that there is a difference with immunotherapy that, you know, having a PCR is not the same if you got chemo compared to chemo immunotherapy. And so nice to see that that benefit is seen even in the PCR population. But to me, these data were nice because most of our triple negative cancers typically recur if they're going to recur in the first 3 to 5 years. So seeing 5 year data is, you know, real reflective of, I think, what we're going to see overall in the long term. And so really important to see these benefits at that time point.
You want to talk about NeoTRIP?
Sure. So, I mean, I think this study was just kind of more curious. You know, we'd seen before that the taxane regimen, this is non-anthracycline in the pre-op setting. When you added atezolizumab, you did not improve pathologic complete response rates. And, you know, when we saw this, I think we were all a bit puzzled about why that is. And now we're seeing the event-free survival data. So the longer follow-up, and again, you see no benefit. So a lot of us are questioning, well, why is it in this trial that there was no benefit to giving a checkpoint inhibitor like atezolizumab? Is it because there was no anthracycline given preoperatively concurrently with the checkpoint inhibitor? Do you need that anthracycline there? I would argue I'm not sure that's the case because we've seen data from NeoPACT looking at docetaxel carboplatin pembro, which had a PCR similar to KEYNOTE-522. other people are saying maybe it's a tezo, you know, it's a PD-L1 inhibitor, not a PD-1 inhibitor. Maybe it's not quite as good. But on the flip side, we've seen data from IMPASSION-031 with ACT, atezo, also improving response rates. But maybe it's something about this patient population. It was very high risk. Over half the patients had locally advanced tumors. There were imbalances in the arms with higher TIL in the control arm. So, you know, I think the answer is we don't know why this is negative, and we'll have to get more data. There is a study, Jeopardus, which is looking at pre-op anthracycline, taxane, platinum chemo with or without atezo, just like KEYNOTE-522. And so if that's positive, you know, that'll sort of solidify in my mind that, you know, atezolizumab does work with longer follow-up, but we need that data to understand.
Yeah, I was telling Sarah that, you know, on Tuesday we were talking about a trial that, you know, in endometrial cancer, dostarlimab and pembrolizumab both have activity in MS-stable disease, and they presented an atezo paper at ESMO, which was negative in that particular subset. You know, you never know. Is it, you know, we have enough data to really know there's a difference between PD-1 inhibitors, or as you said, is maybe the setting of it. Maybe you can present this 44-year-old woman to Aditya and see how he would manage it.
I think this was really a case that brought out the challenges of some of the immune-related toxicities that we are seeing in real life now that we're giving a lot of checkpoint inhibitors to her pre-op triple-negative patients. So this was a young, healthy, premenopausal woman who came in with a 4-centimeter mass, you know, confirmed on MRI, actually about 5 centimeters on MRI. And she did have enlarged axillary nodes and came back with a biopsy of her breast mass that came back triple negative, and the FNA of her axillary node was positive. So we did give her the pre-op KEYNOTE-522 regimen. She started off with the carbo-taxane pembro portion of 522, but just a few weeks after starting, she calls me, you know, she paged me and she's like, I have chest pain. And I'm like, huh, this is a young, healthy woman. This isn't like cardiac chest pain, right? Like, you know, like she's not having an MI, but it was very weird and it was persistent. You know, we tried some anti-inflammatory drugs, but it really persisted over the next day. I had her call me a couple times, but finally I just sent her to the ER because I was like, this is, something's wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, I worry about myocarditis, pericarditis, all the funky, you know, immunotherapy side effects we can see. And so she did, when she was in the ER, they did an echo and she had a small pericardial effusion and cardiology felt it was consistent with pericarditis. So she did start on colchicine and ibuprofen. And I, of course, consulted my cardio-oncology colleagues because I get nervous with these situations. And they got a cardiac MRI and repeated cardiac enzymes. Her MRI was normal and her troponin was flat. And her symptoms actually went away after being on colchicine ibuprofen. So they made me follow regular EKGs and troponins, which were all fine. But then in my mind, my question was, do I restart her pembro? Like I continued her on chemo. But I was a little scared, I have to be honest. You know, cardiac toxicity from immunotherapy does make me a bit uncomfortable. But the cardiologist swore it was okay to retry. So I did give her the pembro again. But I'm curious, Aditya, I don't know if you've kind of come into this situation with pericarditis, but would you retry the pembro, or how would you feel about it? Obviously, she had a high-risk cancer, so it was a, you know, tough decision.
Yeah, absolutely tough decision. I would be quite concerned about using pembro again. Although I guess, you know, with pericarditis or rash, it could be done, but you just worry about the side effects. But as long as the patient has close monitoring and the cardiology team feels comfortable and they are available to help out, I think it's reasonable to do it. One thing we've seen is that troponin is a very sensitive marker for myocarditis, and that's what you worry about when you're using immunotherapy. So as long as there's serial troponins, I guess could be done.
So I was rooting for not doing it, but anyhow, hopefully everything will work out. Real quick, from the chat room, Aditya from Lillian wants to know, have you had trouble using capecitabine and pembro with concurrent RT after KEYNOTE-522? Apparently she has a patient who had a serious radiation burn. Maybe it was radiation recall. Does that ring any bells with you, Aditya?
In general, we use K capecitabine after radiation. So a patient who has residual disease, generally give radiation first, and then after that, use capecitabine. Generally don't use them together. The pembro could be given with radiation or could be given after radiation as well. There were subset analyses from the KEYNOTE-522 studies that concurrent immunotherapy versus giving immunotherapy sequentially, the outcomes were the same.
I was just thinking, you all in breast, you just joined the ophthalmic club that everybody else already belongs to. You're the last group to, maybe not the last, but anyhow, we'll get to that soon. But one more thing, because I love your cases, Sarah, so why don't you throw this one at Aditya and see what he would do with this 49-year-old lady?
So, Aditya, this was a 49-year-old woman who had a known BRCA mutation. She had actually chosen to just undergo screening. So she was getting every 6-month MRIs alternating with mammography. And on one of these screening tests, she did find that she had a 1.8 centimeter mass that was biopsied and was found to be triple negative disease. We did ultrasound her axilla, which was negative. So she appeared to have a clinically node negative T1C triple negative cancer in the setting of an underlying BRCA mutation. So here, one question is, well, what do you give her? Are you going to give her pre-op therapy? Technically, she's a clinical stage one. Are you going to take her to upfront surgery? Are you going to give her pre-op? And if you do give her chemo, what chemo do you give her? Obviously, she's on the cusp not quite stage two. Do you ever think about immunotherapy here, or would you stick with chemo? So I'm curious to know what you would do seeing that.
Yeah.
Could I just add in, and also what you would do if it was 2.2 centimeters?
Yeah, T1C stuff, if this was T1, T1A, T1B, I would do surgery first. If this was 2.2, I would consider the KEYNOTE-522 regimen, which has shown benefit with immunotherapy both in lymph node positive and negative setting. So for this one, you don't want to take the patient to surgery upfront because you want to see response to therapy. And, you know, like was done, if the patient does have residual disease, you can use olaparib because that is approved for patients who have residual disease despite chemo. Yeah, so I would lean towards neoadjuvant chemo. And if there's residual disease, consider a PARP inhibitor.
Yeah, so it is, you know, I ended up doing that, not giving the pembro because she was a little less than the 2 centimeter mark. So I just did give her anthracycline taxane therapy pre-op.
And no pericarditis either. All right, let's get into the real nitty gritty here, ADCs. And first, a little bit about TDXD. And Aditya, I was mentioning this case of esophageal cancer that had this response to in the brain to TDXD, but I feel like I'm hearing more and more about CNS responsiveness. So can you go through some of the new papers on TDXD and just keep going all the way through to Dato, and then let's sit down and try to figure out what all this means?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think TDXD has challenged the traditional paradigm that these antibody therapies would not work in patients with brain metastases. But we saw pooled analyses from the DESTINY studies, DESTINY-Breast01, 02, 03, which looked at TDXD in patients with brain metastases. And essentially, we could see that TDXD had activity in patients with brain mets, both in the brain met setting as well as, you know, outside, which we know it works very well. And if you compare TDXD to standard of care, the response rate was much, much higher. So like a response rate of, you know, close to 50% with TDXD in the brain as compared to, you know, 12% with standard therapy. So if a patient with HER2 positive disease or other setting does have brain mets, you feel comfortable using TDXD in that setting. And this was also seen in other studies like the Tuxedo trial. The other question that has come up is the definition of HER2-low, because TDXD is used in that setting as well. So just as a reminder, right now, HER2-low is an operational definition, which refers to tumors with IHC 1+ or 2+ without FISH amplification. And the reason we have this classification is because of the DESTINY-Breast04 trial. So DESTINY-Breast04 looked at TDXT versus standard chemotherapy for patients with HER2-low metastatic breast cancer. 90% of the patients enrolled in the trial had hormone receptor positive disease, 10% hormone receptor negative disease. The primary outcome was PFS in patients with hormone receptor positive HER2 low breast cancer. So at ESMO, we saw an update of progression-free survival, and you continue to see that T-DXd has impressive improvement in progression-free survival as compared to standard chemotherapy, 9.6 months PFS versus 4.2 months. And in all patients, so that's hormone receptor positive plus hormone receptor negative, again, there was improvement in progression-free survival. Similarly, overall survival improvement seen with T-DXd with additional follow-up, so close to 2 years of overall survival in patients with hormone receptor positive metastatic breast cancer. So it was just reassuring to see with additional follow-up that T-DXd continues to provide benefit. We also saw at ESMO activity of T-DXd in a basket study, as we were reviewing earlier. This was in the setting of patients with HER2 mutations, and the idea being that if a tumor has HER2 mutation, it would have some HER2 expression, so a drug like T-DXd, which has bystander effect, would work. And overall, you could see responses in different tumor histologies, breast that we know about, as well as other cancers, including rare cancers like salivary gland tumors. But in some subtypes like colorectal cancers, the response rate was lower. Now, this could be because of prior use of other agents like irinotecan, which can have cross-resistance with T-DXd given a similar payload, or it could be something inherent related to colorectal cancers as compared to other cancers. But it does bring up the idea that T-DXd has activity regardless of tumor histology, but we probably have to look at prior history of other therapies before considering the use of this agent. So I wanted to bring
Let's
up
see what
a
Sarah
case.
Thinks about your case.
This is a 55-year-old female with metastatic ER-positive breast cancer, had disease progression of various therapies, and received two lines of chemo, capecitabine and paclitaxel. And the question is, what therapy to consider next? A common scenario that we see in clinic, would you consider eribulin? Would you consider navalbine? Would you consider sacituzumab govitecan or trastuzumab deruxtecan? How do you select between these various therapies?
You know, I think
so,
given
Sarah,
the data,
how would you think through? No, go ahead.
Yeah, no, here we've, this is a patient who's had two lines of chemotherapy in the metastatic setting and is HER2 low ER positive. And so typically if someone has a HER2 low cancer, usually after one line of chemotherapy, I'm often moving to T-DXd. In this case, she's already had two. And so I would also go on to T-DXd here. And the reason I would choose it is if you look at DESTINY-Breast04, it was for people who had one or two lines of chemotherapy. And you see, you know, 50% response rate, you see almost a 10-month PFS. That's far greater than we've seen with any other agents in this setting. Certainly sacituzumab govitecan is also an option. The challenge here, though, is when sacituzumab govitecan was studied in metastatic ER-positive disease in the TROPiCS-02 study, it was looked at, you know, as a later line therapy. And so the PFS that you're seeing, you know, isn't quite as robust as T-DXd, but I think not quite fair given the patient population had a, you know, 2 to 4 prior lines of chemotherapy. But that being said, generally, HER2 low, I give T-DXd first. Often we'll think about sacituzumab next. If they're HER2 zero, I would give sacituzumab, you know, as a second line chemo.
Just to complete the HER2 low scenario, Sarah, what about hormone receptor negative HER2 low? What goes first, sacituzumab or T-DXd? This has been debated ever since the HER2 low data was presented.
Yeah, it's a continues to be debated. So, you know, I think the reason there's a debate is we have data from ASCENT, which had looked at sacituzumab in a phase 3 trial and had improvement in both progression-free and overall survival that was statistically significant. And so, you know, sacituzumab, in my mind, has become a second-line standard of care in metastatic triple-negative disease. Then along came DB04, and it had 58 patients with triple-negative breast cancer that were HER2 low. And so it wasn't statistically powered to look at outcomes in that group of patients, but nonetheless, you saw data that was very similar to the benefits that you saw in the ER-positive HER2 low. You saw the 50% response rate. You saw that large improvement in PFS and OS. But again, the numbers are small and the confidence intervals are wide. We saw even with the updated data, the numbers have shifted a little bit in the triple negative group just because, again, it's a small data set. And so I will typically give sacituzumab first to a triple negative patient that's HER2 low and then T-DXd next.
So Aditi, anything you want to say about some of the ESMO data presented from the TROPiCS-02 study?
Yeah, so we saw subgroup analyses. This was from the TROPiCS-02, which looked at SG versus standard chemotherapy for patients with hormone receptor positive metastatic breast cancer. And this was stratified based on prior lines of therapy. And essentially, in patients who got two or less prior lines of therapy versus more than three, similar outcomes were seen with sacituzumab govitecan, very similar hazard ratios. So essentially, it has become an agent that we use as per label after two prior lines of therapy. So in the third line setting, that's where SG is used. And if a patient has received T-DXd, say in the second line setting, then after that, often we use SG after T-DXd.
I was just going to ask Sarah if she, what her experience is in terms of quality of life, T-DXd and sacituzumab. I'm hearing more about, you know, some of the GI toxicity you get with T-DXd, and of course we have ILD out there. So when you think about the tolerability profiles of these two, because obviously that comes into consideration as well when you're trying to decide what comes first. How do you compare them, Sarah?
Yeah, it's funny. I had clinic today and this came up with a patient. And, you know, it's interesting. They're just so different, right? Because T-DXd, one, patients love it's IV every 3 weeks. So that's a huge issue. You don't have to come into clinic as much, right? With sacituzumab, you're coming in weekly, 2 weeks on, 1 week off. So that oftentimes does influence a patient a bit. One, with sacituzumab, you will go bald if you get that drug. If you've got hair, you're going to lose it. With T-DXd, it's probably about a quarter of people who will go bald if they get T-DXd. So for a woman with hair, that becomes a big issue sometimes with the discussion. I think the other things that come up are blood count issues with sacituzumab. A lot of, you know, half my patients end up on growth factor. Some of them end up with intermittent diarrhea needing loperamide. With T-DXd, it's the nausea. But I do find with the three drug prophylaxis for T-DXd, it works great. And so people, for most of my patients, sometimes need an extra dose of either olanzapine or Zofran over those 3 weeks to control the nausea. But obviously it's the ILD that I most worry about with T-DXd. And, you know, we are seeing a lot of grade one ILD as we're scanning people, and it does become a, you know, an issue. There's a lot of dose holds and, you know, you have to stop the drug if you get a grade two ILD. So that is an issue that does come up. But again, very just different side effect profiles.
Aditi, any comments? I guess one thing, you know, that I kind of wonder about, I hear these stories about people, they're having great responses and then they see some stuff on the x-ray, you don't know what to do. Do you give them steroids, et cetera, the kind of the hassle factor or the, you know, just complication factor that maybe ILD brings to the picture. Anything else you want to add in terms of your own observations, Aditi, in terms of these two ADCs?
Yeah, pneumonitis management is important. And as per current guidelines, patients who have grade 2 pneumonitis, so that's symptoms, and that symptom could be vague like cough or even mild shortness of breath, T-DXd should be permanently discontinued. But I think in the clinic, we are questioning that. If a patient is on T-DXd, has mild symptoms, and the pneumonitis resolves, can he use T-DXd again? Or you can give another drug, and then maybe in the future, can he use T-DXd again? So I think this grade 2 pneumonitis and completely discontinuing T-DXd is questionable.
Yeah, and you know, when we talk to the lung people and the GI people, they're like, you know, they want to, of course, you see somebody responding, you want to put them back on it, but they don't have the experience that you all do with the drug. All right, Dato-DXd. Aditi, can you talk about what it is?
So that's the third ADC besides T-DXd and SG. And it uses Trop-2 ADC, but a different antibody than sacituzumab govitecan. And in terms of its construct, it has a stable linker payload and tumor-selective cleavable linker. And both these properties reduce the off-target side effect that's seen with the ADC. But it does have bystander effect like T-DXd, so can address tumor heterogeneity. So we saw some results in the phase 1, phase 2 study. It's given every 3 weeks, good safety profile and evidence of clinical activity. So TROPION-Breast01 was designed as the registration phase 3 trial comparing T-DXd versus standard chemotherapy in patients who had received at least one prior line of chemotherapy. So it's second line plus setting, similar to DESTINY-Breast04. The primary endpoint, it had two primary endpoints, progression-free survival as well as overall survival. So bottom line, the study met its primary endpoint. There was improvement in progression-free survival with a hazard ratio of 0.63. And if you look at the curve, slight initial drop and then separation that is maintained. So in terms of PFS rate, at 9 months, it was 18% with standard therapy versus 37% with Dato-DXd. And similar results with investigator-assessed PFS as well. Now, one interesting thing that was seen in the trial, and personally, I actually had not appreciated much when this drug was being used in the phase one setting, was the safety profile, that the incidence of AEs grade 3 or higher were lower with Dato-DXd as compared to standard chemotherapy, about half grade 3 events as compared to standard chemotherapy. Now, it's not like the drug does not have side effects. It does have side effects, mucositis, as well as ocular toxicity, which for some patients could be problematic. In this trial, the rate of discontinuation was very low. Only one patient discontinued Dato-DXd for mucositis and one because of ocular side effects. And the rate of ILD was much lower as compared to T-DXd, was about 3%, while with T-DXd it's about 10 to 15%. And with chemo, you saw the chemo side effects, neutropenia, including 31% grade 3 or higher neutropenia. We also saw the results from Begonia study, which combined Dato with Durva, and a very impressive response rate of close to 80% in patients with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, which was regardless of the PD-L1 expression. And we also saw median PFS and duration of response, and a median PFS of 13.8 months for patients with metastatic TNBC, something we've not seen with other drugs. So it was good to see activity of combination of Dato plus Durva, and there are additional registration trials that look at this combo.
Before you get into the case, maybe just pause for a second and, kind of reflect back on some of the things that you've talked about, and also to get Sarah's input. And I will mention too, Sarah, that in bladder cancer, they have a PD-1 plus ADC approved first line now, and Fortimab plus Pembro. Originally, it was just in older people, but it looks like it's going to be maybe beat out cisplatinum chemotherapy, amazingly enough. But the idea of an ADC plus an IO makes a lot of sense, because we know chemo plus IO, lung cancer, et cetera, makes a lot of sense. It'll be really interesting to see how that combination is received. But let's just talk about single agent, first of all. In terms of tolerability, Sarah, I know you've used the drug as well. Can you provide a little more, description of what you've observed in patients in terms of the types of mucositis? The lung people are asking us about mucositis because they've never had to deal with it, but you guys have dealt with it for a long time. So does the usual stuff work? Is it like, everolimus somatitis? And also, what have you seen in the eyes? It sounds like it's not a big deal and it goes away and all, but I also, in these other tumors, I also hear patients, get nervous about it, which is understandable. So what did you take away from all this, Sarah?
Yeah, I will say, you're right. We've had experience using everolimus for years and got used to managing mucositis using Decadron mouth rinse, which does work very well from a prevention standpoint. So I will say when we started enrolling patients on the Dato-DXd phase one trial early on when this drug was being studied, we just gave everyone Decadron prophylaxis because we really wanted to help prevent those issues with the stomatitis. And I will say I thought it worked pretty well. So all the patients I've ever treated, I always treated them with prophylaxis. It was recommended to be utilized in TROPION-Breast01, but probably not utilized across the board. And so I will say most of my patients had pretty good control, that they either didn't have any mucositis or they'd get, mild intermittent mucositis, but I didn't have anyone with bad mucositis on it. So I did feel like it worked well to use.
So here's a scenario, or actually this is a, I think is this a case or a scenario? I think it was a scenario that you put together, Aditya, just to sort of see what Sarah would think. So Sarah, let's imagine you've got a 45-year-old woman, hormone receptor positive, IHC low, IHC 1, and of course she's at the interesting point of having completed capecitabine, BRCA negative, ESR1 negative, PIK3 negative. So Aditya's got all the bases covered to try to get you to say, what are you going to pick amongst those four, particularly the last three?
Well, so it sounds like she has hormone receptor positive HER2 low disease. She's already progressed on a line of chemotherapy, in this case, capecitabine. So what are you going to do as your next line? I actually just literally had this patient this afternoon, and we did debate doing IV weekly Taxol or doing TDXD. She had not had a taxane yet, and so I think that that's also a reasonable choice. But the TDXD, you know, PFS is really just so robust in HER2 low disease. This case says she's interested in minimal myelosuppression. You know, there is some neutropenia with TDXD, but, you know, I've not had to run into any issues with dose holds due to neutropenia or needing to use growth factor with TDXD. So I think it's probably okay. Obviously, sacituzumab, as listed here, would have a lot of issues with neutropenia. But again, in a HER2 low patient, I would have chosen TDXD over sacituzumab. You know, Dato's listed here as a choice. We can pretend if it was already approved and it was a choice, would you use it? I would choose TDXD over Dato, given the very robust data that we've seen with, you know, 50% response rate and 10-month PFS, whereas Dato, the response rate's, you know, over 30%, and the PFS is, you know, a little under 7 months. And so I just think the robustness of TDXD sort of makes me choose it generally over Dato or sacituzumab in this setting.
So difficult when you have to do indirect comparison. Again, Aditi, I'm kind of focusing my attention on options 2, 3, and 4 there in your list. Again, as Sarah was saying, let's assume you could access Dato. When you think about these three antibody drug conjugates, at least based on what we know right now, Aditya, like what kind of patient would you be thinking about for Dato? What kind of patient would you be thinking about for SASI or trastuzumab or TDXD, IHC 0 versus IHC low?
In general, I agree with Sarah that patient with HER2 low disease, the prioritization would be TDXD as the first ADC to use, unless there's a contraindication like pneumonitis or some other reason. If a patient has HER2 IHC 0, so at this time TDXD is not approved in that setting, and if Dato gets approved, then it'll be a choice between Dato and SG, and it'll boil down to the safety profile. Dato is given every 3 weeks, has less neutropenia, myelosuppression. SG has overall survival data. We've not seen overall survival data with Dato DXD, so all of these factors would come into therapeutic decision making. Once you decide on the first ADC, eventually patients do have disease progression. And in general, physicians are using a second ADC after the first ADC. So even if a patient gets TDXD and has disease progression, we'll grapple with the issue of then should I use SG or Dato DXD after that.
And Sarah, you know, I'm starting to hear people talk about ADCs like they used to talk about chemo in terms of resistance and you know, when you can, you need to not use it, et cetera. Any thoughts about how you're going to choose between Dato and sacituzumab if TDXD, again, let's say IHC is zero? You know, one of the things I'm not getting a really good clear feel about is I know you kind of have this feeling that TDXD has, you know, very potent, but, you know, what do we really know about relative efficacy of these three ADCs?
Yeah, it's a good point. We don't, because as you're pointing out, we're making very crude cross-trial comparisons with different patient populations. And so, you know, we don't have good data comparing these ADCs head-to-head. You know, for example, when you look at the sacituzumab data, again, 2 to 4 prior lines of chemo with hormone receptor positive disease, but the Dato studies was 1 to 2 prior lines of chemo. So you can't really, if you're trying to say who's better, Dato or sacituzumab, you can't really compare, right? Because they're totally different patient populations. You know, nonetheless, the PFS isn't that different between the two. You know, it's numerically certainly higher with dato, but again, they're less pretreated. Also, you know, TROPiCS-02, everyone had a prior CDK. Not everyone did in TROPA and Breast 01. So again, there's challenges with this cross-trial comparison issue. So I would say we don't know who's better. I think your point about thinking about resistance is a good one because, you know, if you're also thinking about what to do after one ADC, you're sort of wondering, can I give another ADC? Why did they become resistant to that ADC? You know, they're all having topo one payloads. And so if you're resistant to the payload, is the next ADC actually going to work? And, you know, I know Aditya's group has done a little work trying to look at how these ADCs work at one after the other and resistance mechanisms. But I think we're just not there yet with understanding the optimal sequencing.
So just as a little dessert here, why don't we just talk about another ADC real quick? We actually have like three or four queued up. Let's just talk about one. I'm waiting to hear next Tuesday. I keep trying to figure out why patritumab works in recurrent EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer, which is, it works there, but it also seems like it works in metastatic breast cancer. So what's HER3, Aditya? What's patritumab? And does it have a future in breast cancer?
Well, that's another ADC with the deruxtecan payload. It targets HER3 and has a similar construct to T-DXd and Dato-DXd, but the difference being that it targets HER3 as opposed to TROP2 or HER2. And we have seen data from a basket study looking at patients with metastatic breast cancer, triple negative, ER positive, HER2 positive, and efficacy seen regardless of the subtype of breast cancer. In terms of side effect, it has a different side effect profile than the other agents. The rate of pneumonitis is lower and tends to cause more heme and GI toxicity with thrombocytopenia as well as neutropenia. So it's interesting that you have now three ADCs with deruxtecan payload, but the side effect profile is not identical, which also talks to the differences in the antibody and uptake of the ADCs in different tissues. Now, the other question is, does the level of HER3 expression in the tumor matter? So we saw this at ASCO presented by Erica Hamilton, where it was an interesting investigator-initiated trial looking at patritumab deruxtecan, but by levels of HER3 expression and levels of ER expression. And the bottom line is that the levels of HER3 expression did not predict for activity with patritumab deruxtecan. So very similar to, I guess, like HER2 or TROP2, there's no strong correlation between the expression of the antigen and activity with these antibody drug conjugates.
So we could continue on for a long time, but I think we better just cut it off at this point and give people's brains a rest for the evening. But Aditya and Sarah, thank you so much. As always, I was really looking forward to this, and you certainly did not disappoint. I learned so much. I'm sure everybody else did too as well. Come on back next Tuesday. We're going to actually spend an hour and a half talking about we're going to talk about small cell as well. Guess what? It got a bispecific in small cell that looks like it works. So it looks like the lung cancer people are going to have to learn about CRS, which the oncologists are already looking at. Who knows, maybe breast cancer will come up with a bispecific like that as well. But anyhow, we'll be talking about that and more next Tuesday. The audience, come on back next Tuesday. We'll hear what they all have to say. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Aditya. Thanks, Sarah. Have a good one.
Thank you.
Thank you.